This episode of Infinite Canvas Ultra is sponsored by Overacting. When life hands you a bad script, just overact. Welcome to a new episode of Infinite Canvas Ultra. This week, we are talking about one of the biggest films of the summer. Michael, take it away.
We are going to be talking about Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw.
Damn straight we are. My first introduction to the Fast and Furious franchise. First Fast and Furious film I have seen.
We're gonna open a can of whoop-ass on this film.
Damn straight we are. Also this week, we are talking about First Taste, the new album by Ty Segall. And also, we are going to recount our time at Pitchfork Music Festival this year, a Chicago tradition that Michael and I always make a habit of doing every year. Always a great music festival, and just going to talk about who we saw, some highlights, some lowlights, although there wasn't really many. Everything was pretty good. Other than just heat exhaustion, that was definitely one of the lowest points.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a good time as always, so stay tuned and, you know, just doing what we're doing. Infinite Canvas Ultra.
Let's go.
Just 2 weeks ago. It was 2 weeks ago now, right? Pitchfork?
Yeah, yes. That sounds right. July 19th through the 21st or something?
Yeah, actually by the time this episode airs, it'll probably be like 4 weeks.
Close by to then. Month, yeah.
Yeah, but hey. Always good to talk about it. Always an event worth talking about. So for those of you that don't know or, you know, maybe aren't from the area, Pitchfork Music Festival is a music festival that happens in Union Park in Chicago every year. This was my 8th year of going to it, which is pretty insane.
Yeah. This was my 4th year going. My first one was in 2016, and I've gone at least one day every year since.
Yeah. It's always just the best of the best for Chicago music festivals. Mm-hmm. Always just more centric around, like, kind of, I mean, not to sound like a pretentious dick, but just kind of like more like music nerd centric artists, kind of more like if you follow blogs and, you know, just music websites, it's kind of centric more towards that type of fan base.
Basically, if you're a fan of the Needle Drop, you might have some crossover with the Pitchfork Music Festival.
That is for sure.
Very indie scene heavy bands and artists who play at Pitchfork every year.
Exactly. It's the one festival where anytime I tell somebody that I'm going to it and they ask me who I'm going to see, I'm just like, lots of people, everybody. I don't really specify much because it's just like, yeah, you've never heard of any of these bands, but it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. Usually it's always a catch-all when you're just like, oh, I'm excited for all of it.
Right. You know?
And it's the truth.
I mean, that is, for the most part, kind of actually true with Pitchfork.
Exactly. Without fail, every year, it's almost kind of like more work to take time away and like not see acts and, you know, take a break because there usually, without fail, is something that I'd like to go catch or there's an artist that I have a deep appreciation for or am straight up just a huge fan of that I'll want to catch a set from. So I typically go all 3 days. Michael, you went just on Sunday this year.
Yep, just Sunday this year.
Yeah, but
The Friday and, you know, well, I'm sure we'll talk about the schedule, but the Friday and Saturday lineups weren't so heavy for me this year. But Sunday I have a good amount to talk about.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, and for me, I think probably my favorite day, I have the lineup in front of me right now, just kind of giving myself a refresher on it. Friday and Sunday were definitely the best days. I mean, there were 2 days that I spent the largest amount of time at, because Saturday, frankly, I just couldn't muster the energy. Friday was I've been going to this since I was 17, so that was like 2012. This is the hottest year by far, which I have never experienced, like, heat exhaustion in general, but like heat exhaustion to that degree.
Right.
Like, I got there in the, like, at the very beginning, like around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and by 7. Typically, I can make the whole day, and it's fine. But by 7 o'clock, I literally had to just sit around and just kind of, like, prepare myself to get on the train. And then once I got on the train to get back to my car, I had to sit in my car for, like, another 20 minutes with just air blasting on me before I could drive home because I was just so fatigued.
Right. It was, like, reaching over 100 degrees that day, right?
Yeah.
Wow. I am so glad that I was able to miss that.
It was absolutely insane. And I'll give Pittsburgh credit. They tried to provide, you know, a good amount of accommodations, cooling buses, blah, blah, blah. Weren't really too helpful. Of course, like, everybody was kind of packed on there.
Yeah,
and there
I'm sure
was, like,
everyone was cramming into there, right?
Also coupled with that, very minimal amount of seats, but I appreciate the effort. I mean, yeah. They still tried, so it was good. But despite all the heat, great time. Friday was definitely a more, for me personally, kind of fell more on, like, the hip-hop oriented spectrum of my musical taste. A extremely great up-and-coming rapper from New York, Mike, who was somebody, hey, shares a name with our second host here, was somebody that I was extremely excited to see. For those of you that have never heard of him, please, please go listen to War in My Pen by him. I think it's one of the best experimental hip-hop albums to come out last year. Speaking of that, Earl Sweatshirt played that day, who put out easily, like, one of my favorite albums of last year, in my top five, without a doubt. Seeing Pusha T was also extremely great, who, again, another artist who was, like, three rappers who put out, you know, three of my favorite records of the year back to back to back. So that was a really great time. Yeah. Gotta give definitely a mention to Standing on the Corner, who is a improvisational jazz outfit from New York, who played a stunning set early on in the day at the Green Stage at Pitchfork, which they're a 2-piece band, but they actually had, like, a full ensemble with them. They had, like, probably about 14, maybe 15 wow. people on stage with them, and it was absolutely incredible.
That's awesome.
It was great. It was really amazing. And I mean, it wasn't my favorite performance of the weekend, but it's definitely up there.
Sure.
It's up there for sure.
Yeah.
Saturday, like,
You did not go and see Haim, who was the headliner for Friday?
I wanted to see them so badly, but the heat exhaustion, man. It sure. was just getting to me.
That was the thing I would have went for Friday. You know, I'm not much of an Earl Sweatshirt fan. I don't know Mike or Standing on the Corner. I do like Pusha T. I would have liked to see Pusha T. His record from last year was really great.
And his set was absolutely incredible, just super energetic. It was everything you'd want it to
That's
be.
That's awesome.
It was absolutely amazing.
But yeah, if I were to have gone on Friday, it definitely would have been mostly for Haim. Who I heard good reports that they were really good. So.
And they seem to be active again. I saw that they have another
new single
out. I see there's another Paul Thomas Anderson directed video accompanying it. I've yet to watch that and listen to that song, actually.
Sounds pretty cool.
I'm excited to check it out.
I gave it a listen the other day. The video's kind of neat as well.
Yeah, good to see them back. Early shout out to Haim.
Yeah, early shout out to Haim.
Yeah, good old Haim. And then on Saturday, there was a lot that I wanted to see. Saturday was definitely the more indie-centric day with this incredibly great band from Japan, Chai, who played early in the day. And then we have experimental singer-songwriter Kate LeBon, who I've seen her before, actually met her once, super cool. And then the band that I've probably seen more than any other band, Parquet Courts, played that day too. Unfortunately, yeah, even though it was so stacked, I just kind of chilled out, but it was all worth it because then I got there for Stereolab, which was an iconic indie band from France who has just reunited after 10 years. They put on a phenomenal set. They're kind of more indie, like, dance-centric by way of, like, kind of psychedelic rock. They're incredible and put on an absolutely amazing set. Belle and Sebastian was pretty great, too. Saturday was kind of my socialized day.
Sure.
I mean, I showed up so late, but then just kind of, like, hung out with friends. Yeah. But all led up into the Isley Brothers, who put on such a good set and was something that I was just not expecting.
Right.
Like, it was a treat. Like, that was literally just what summer music festivals are all about. It was incredible. And it was just, like, it's not surprising, but it was definitely one of those things where you realize of seeing them live, you know so much more of their material than you actually realized.
Sure, yeah.
And it was really cool. It was amazing experiencing that and just like seeing the crowd reaction and just how into the crowd, like how into the show the crowd was great. It was
That's
a great
awesome.
cap off to that day. And now we're on Sunday, a day where both Michael and I were there. And yeah, you want to take that off? What were some of your biggest highlights
Yeah,
for
sure.
that?
I could talk about Sunday. So we got there on Sunday around like 1 p.m. It had been raining that morning, so they held everyone off until the gates opened around 1 p.m. when we got there.
A lot of rain this year too,
yeah.
Covering the heat. That was one thing on Saturday. Even though I showed up late, when I showed up, they were evacuating.
Right.
So thankfully, there was a conveniently placed tent right by where I was standing, so it was nice and dry. And then I ended up actually running into friends underneath that tent right after. So it was actually a pretty amazing time, even though like it should have sucked.
Right. Well, I mean, you skipped out on having to be, you know, one of the evacuees. So
that's true.
You got there right in the nick of time.
It was unintentionally a really good call on my
right.
part.
So yeah, when we got there, we caught one song by Snail Mail because they were doing the sound check.
Exactly.
Right when we got there.
It was great because Snail Mail. I mean, I'm not the biggest Snail Mail fan, but she's definitely somebody I would have seen if there wasn't...
If Charli XCX wasn't playing.
Yeah, I was going to say if there was anybody that I really wanted to see... If there wasn't somebody I really wanted to see playing at the same time she was, I would have caught her, but it was great seeing her sound check. But the other thing that made that whole situation great was just how awkward that situation was.
Right.
Because Snail Mail, I want to say Snail Mail, I could have swore she was 17, but I think she's still super young. She might be a little bit older than that, but she's still like a very young artist. And she's easily one of the biggest acts on this bill for this mm-hmm. weekend, especially in the world of indie, which I mean is what Pitchfork is kind of founded on. It's like founded on being an indie rock festival. So just her doing a sound check warranted like a huge turnout. And I mean, huge for a sound check, mind you. And Michael and I were there. They played one song, and then the front person of Snail Mail, she just kind of looks to the side and just says, can we stop playing now?
It was so awkward. It ends
the sound check, which was absolutely incredible, but I'm so happy I got to experience that moment.
I honestly felt, you know, I was feeling awkward even walking up to the stage because, like, when we got to Pitchfork on Sunday, we were maybe one of, like, 100 people there. There was nobody there yet.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, which is... not the norm for around that time.
Never.
Usually there's a good amount of people there.
Usually you're
early.
Waiting in a line to get in, you know, at the start of the day.
Exactly.
We got there, maybe 100 people there all together just walking around, and maybe 15, 20 people in front of the blue stage watching Snail Mail get ready for this. And I didn't know, when we walked up, we didn't really know who it was, who was playing. I thought it was just like the first band was playing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't want to go watch the first band play.
Exactly.
And then, like, not know who they are and not care about them and walk away and have them, like, visibly see me walking away. So.
Exactly.
I felt very awkward about it. And then we, you know, Dan found out, you know, realized that it was actually Snail Mail. And
yeah,
that,
I recognized the song. I think she was playing her song Heatwave. And, yeah, at the time, I just assumed, given the time, and I think by the time they started letting people in, it was kind of a little bit over the scheduled time, so I thought maybe they were just getting that artist out there right away, which unfortunately, whoever was supposed to play the blue stage that day at that time probably got cut. There was a lot of
I think it was, at least looking at the schedule right here, there was a green stage and a red stage at 1 and 1:45, and I think both of those got cut.
Oh.
I think Black Midi at 2:30 was the first act to go on. Maybe
more on Black Midi later.
Right, maybe the first performer was the red stage one, but I know that Dreezy on the green stage got cut, which is unfortunate. Like, a lot of people got cut this year. Kurt Vile,
which is a really big name, cut from the festival.
There was another one. Was it Parquet Courts only played a few songs or something?
Yeah, they got cut short because during their set was when the evacuation happened.
Right, when the rainstorm came down and
so they got through about half of their set and ended up having to leave, which those are two major ones. It does, I actually, speaking of Chicago shows, it looks like Kurt Vile actually has rescheduled to play like Goose Island Festival or something coming up, so
that's cool.
He's still getting his Chicago days.
As long as he's coming back and people are able to see him.
Exactly.
So why don't we, you know, we can move on and then I'll talk about some of the people we actually saw that day.
The whole snail mail thing was absolutely amazing.
Right.
I'm so glad that happened.
Yeah, it was a weird little moment.
It was. But yeah, amazing day all around on Sunday.
So we saw, what did we see? We saw Black Midi.
Black Midi.
JPEG Mafia,
which, oof, so good. That was my second time seeing
him. That was really fun. We saw, a bit of
Abai? Yeah, I believe that's how their group is pronounced. Really great. Really great kind of
pretty cool.
Just sort of like Afro pop centric experimental music. Mm-hmm. They're really great. Artists that I want to kind of like dive more into. They were like someone I wanted to check out more even before we caught their set, and seeing their set makes me want to do that even more. Amen Dunes, which is a huge favorite of mine. It was good seeing him. Been a fan of him for quite a long time, and they've kind of just slept on chances like of seeing him play a proper show, so it was good getting to catch him there at Pitchfork. Saw a little bit of Whitney.
A little bit of Whitney we caught. I'm actually wearing my Whitney shirt as we record this right now, which I picked up from Pitchfork.
There you go. Talk a little bit about Whitney.
Sure. Whitney's a folk pop duo based in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Although kind of like the one, what, Standing on the Corner you were talking about?
Yeah.
Like where it's a duo, but when they play live and here at Pitchfork again, they played with, what, maybe 10 to 12 people on stage.
Oh, yeah. They had a huge band with them.
Huge band. They even had a three-piece string outfit with them, which was really cool to see. So they were doing, you know, some strings and some songs that don't even have it, which was really cool to hear. We only caught a little bit of that, but they have a new album coming out next month. Or actually, I guess it's this month now because it's August. They have an album coming out at the end of the month that I'm super psyched about.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up missing out on some of them because we were meeting up with a friend. But at the same time, Charlie XCX was coming up next and we needed to get a good spot for what was my personal, most hyped up artist of the day.
That was amazing. That was even better than what I was expecting it to be. I was expecting it to be a very good time. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Charlie XCX, mm-hmm. but she really brought it. Just her stage presence, her charisma. Yeah,
very enthusiastic. You know, she loved the crowd. The crowd was very into her. You know, everyone knew every word and every song. And she brought out Cupcake to do lip gloss, which was super incredible.
Just everything went over so well. Hearing Boys live was absolutely incredible. Yeah. And that just was so much fun to just be in the crowd for that. The entire crowd singing along and, you know, just having a fucking blast. It was amazing.
Charlie XCX was really great. And then after that, to cap the night off, we saw Robin.
Which was amazing, too. Another pop act that I've, you know, been a fan of for quite a while. And it was really, really awesome to see her. She's kind of an artist that I honestly never really anticipated to catch live. Because usually, whatever venue she plays, it's like kind of way too big and you're not really gonna get that good of a spot to see her, or you know, it's just like sells out pretty fast. So, and then like her headlining Pitchfork was great. I mean, a little bit of like technical issues I would say on stage. The set was very quiet.
Very quiet for the first, like, at least for the first like half of it. Like you could barely hear her vocal performances. A lot of like synths like weren't coming through real good.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little disappointing at first, but I think it got better along the way. It was definitely a really cool set to see.
Absolutely.
Visually it was really intriguing, and you know, outside of the, you know, sea of people we were in, we didn't really get great spots for it, and you know, all the tall people in front of us, but it was a fun time. It was a good time.
So many tall people.
Yeah.
Bane of my existence. Uh-huh. For the audience that doesn't know, I go to quite a lot of shows, being the huge music nerd that I am, and without fail, there's almost always a tall person.
Always.
But So you were saying Charli XCX was your favorite set of
Oh
that
yeah,
day?
Charli XCX was definitely my favorite. You know, obviously, I'm a huge fan of hers. I didn't get to catch all of Whitney, so it, you know, it's hard to really put them into the list. Robin was great, but oh, and JPEG Mafia was really fun too. He actually came out into the crowd and was
That
like
was
standing
amazing.
and rapping and moshing, what, 5 feet
Oh
from
yeah,
us.
he was out in the crowd for a good majority of that set. That was without a doubt the most punk rock thing I've seen at
Yeah,
Pitchfork
so
ever.
energetic. That
It
guy
was
can just go
incredible.
on forever.
And that's he, because when I saw him for the first time, for those of you who don't know about JPEG Mafia, JPEG Mafia is just this ultra abrasive, super experimental hip hop act. Think Death Grips by way of like the Wu-Tang Clan basically, and I would say that's kind of his sound. And yeah, his energy was just palpable. It was amazing. We were literally standing just a couple feet away from him at one point, and we were kind of far,
Yeah,
in
we
all
were.
honesty,
Yeah.
from like the actual stage. So the
He
fact that he made it out that far is
right.
quite
He actually
impressive.
he parted the right side of the stage and like made people make space for him to run out, and he ran, you know, 30 feet into the crowd
Yep.
and then was moshing with people, like rapping while people were moshing with him. It was crazy.
It
It
was
was awesome.
amazing. It was so good. And that's the exact kind of, I mean, it's easier to, when I saw him for the first time, I was at a significantly smaller venue, obviously just a small club. And it was so great seeing him bring that same energy and able to pull off that same energy and experience of a small club to a huge festival like
Right.
Pitchfork without fail. Just amazing, amazing performer, and I'm so glad to see him get so much more recognition in a lot of online circles, and I think he's just gonna kind of get bigger from here, and that's really great.
Yeah.
I hope he has another project lined up soon, because it'd be great to hear more from him. If you haven't, check out his previous album Veteran. It was on every music blog's like top 10 list, and it deserves to be there because it's phenomenal. It's an absolutely great album. But we got to talk about my favorite set of that day, maybe the whole weekend, and just my new favorite band in general, Black Midi, four extremely weird kids from the UK. I shouldn't say kids, they're like 4 years younger than me, but they look young as fuck. They look like they're 60.
Yeah, they really do. I mean, honestly, they are what, like 20?
Yeah, they all clock out at 20.
Yeah, the even the singer is...
You know, he looks like a little boy.
He
It's
does,
so
but
funny.
He has the deepest voice.
Yeah.
Just a powerful presence to him.
Absolutely.
And this is a band that they released an album, their debut album, what, 3 months ago? 3-4 months ago?
Actually, it was only... that was in June, like the
oh,
end of
so,
June.
Okay, so
it's
even
fresh.
Less of time.
Yeah, which their new album, Schlangenheim, which I think is probably a real word. I don't know.
It sounds German.
It sounds
or something.
Very German. Yeah, that's... bit of a spoiler if we ever do like a middle of the year or year end. I mean, hell, maybe something else will come out that'll top this, but Black Midi's debut is my favorite album of the year so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is absolutely wonderful. It is just such a unique rock record. It is one of the most unique rock records I've ever heard, and I listen to that thing like multiple times a week and just cannot get enough of it, and I love it deeply. And needless to say, given that that's how I feel about that record, I was absolutely stoked to see them, and they killed it. That was one of the best performance, like one of the best rock shows I've seen in quite a while.
They brought the house down, honestly.
They
it
really
was,
did.
I'm coming to the album. Or to the band, Dan had, you know, told me about him, and he even, you know, prefaced it like, this probably isn't going to be your thing. And I tried it out, and musically it was good. You know, they're instrumentally, the band is, you know, top of their game, even at only 20 years old, you know, all the members. But I the singer, you know, or if you can call him that, the vocalist, you know, it's very... almost just like speech, in some ways, and his deep voice, and it's hard to tell if he's even speaking English.
Yeah, which I can assure you from reading the notes on the album, Pretty much all of that actually is English,
Sure.
if it's not just
I
gibberish
believe
and kind of
you.
like, just being really spastic and
Right.
I don't know what you want to call a lot of that,
So
but
it didn't translate for me in terms of an album, just listening to it at home or anything, but in the live setting with the whole band there and seeing them really work their magic, like it was really actually powerful. And I really like the drummer was insanely
Oh, their
good. Like
drummer
their
is
drummer is
amazing.
crazy. Like he was awesome.
Just from listening to that record, I knew that their drummer would be absolutely amazing to witness live,
Right.
and sure enough,
And they
absolutely
killed it.
killed
They
it.
honestly, they all killed it. Like the guitarist went at one point, the guitarist who's wearing this long brimmed hat and you can't see his face
It
at
also should
first.
be noted that the vocals are kind of split up between both guitarist and the bassist, but and I didn't realize this. Honestly, on the record, I thought it was just the bass player and one of the guitar players handling the vocal duties, but then the rhythm guitar player ended up doing vocal duties for one of the other songs. And yeah, this is
Right.
leading into what Michael was about to talk
Yeah,
about.
so he's are you that's not the lead guitarist?
Actually, you know
That
what?
probably would
Yeah,
be the lead
that would be the
guitarist,
lead
right?
guitarist, yep.
The lead guitarist is wearing this long-brimmed hat. You can't see his face the entire time. He's kind of looking down. And then at one point, halfway through the set, he just takes off the hat, and you just get one look at him, and you just go, this guy's gonna do something
Just
really
this
fucking
crazed,
weird.
like
This
animalistic
guy
look
is
in his
gonna go
eyes.
off, and I don't know what's coming. And he just stepped up to the mic, just put his lips together, and just started like vibrating, like just like right into the like it was the craziest, weirdest, most off. Like, and this crowd around me who like you could tell that right at the front of the stage on the left side of the stage, a lot of fans, people who were totally into it, moshing. But where Dan and I were was kind of just in this crowd of people who probably had no idea who this band was.
Also, where we were, because of the rain, there was a lot of the field was very muddy
Yeah.
and needed to have,
They police like sectioned it off.
yes, it needed to have wood chips and other other item or products used to kind of keep the land dry a little
Right.
bit and like make it less
Walkable
muddy
and
and
stuff.
walkable. So I wasn't able to get to the side where a lot of the fans were. But that was fine because honestly, I mean, we had a great spot for once that area
Right.
clear. But yeah, it was definitely the area for people who had no idea what was going on. And
Exactly.
I think I saw about three or four people walk
Just walk
out.
out. Like, as soon
I
as the
for
guy.
sure saw two of those people look at someone else, go, "What the fuck is this?" and then walk
Another
away.
point was when the guitarist, like, was literally eating his guitar. Like, think, like, Jimi Hendrix, like, playing the guitar with his mouth. But, like, this guitar is literally on the floor, like, fetal position, literally eating his guitar, it looked like. Like, down. Mouth to guitar strings for at least like a minute.
And I'm sure he was either maybe picking or probably doing a thing. There's a thing where you can create a type of noise if you
Sure.
scream into your pickups on your
Sure.
guitar, which I think he was probably doing that. Gosh,
Crazy talented.
saying
Dude.
this all out loud, this really sounds like the weirdest band of all time, and I love it. It's great. Please,
No.
I recommend, well, if you're an adventurous music
Sure.
listener, please listen to Black Midi.
At
Give them
least,
some support.
I will say at least if you can see them live, because obviously I think the album itself is maybe not for everybody, as much as it is like critically lauded and Dan himself loves it. For me, I couldn't get attached to it, but seeing them live was really an experience. It was a lot of fun. They put on a hell of a set and honestly made kind of a fan of me.
That's
If they were
awesome.
at another Pitchfork or another event that I was at, I would totally go see them.
Makes me happy every time
Yeah.
I hear that. But yeah, Pitchfork Music Festival 2019, another one in the books. Can't wait for next year.
Yeah.
And on subject of that, on music news, right after this short break, we're going to be talking about the new Ty Segall album, First Taste. Stick with us. One of the most prolific talents in garage rock is back with his 10th studio album. Of course, I'm talking about Ty Segall, his new album being First Taste. This is the follow-up to last year's Freedom's Goblin and his collaborative record with White Fence, Joy. Yes, both of those records coming out in the same year. Keeping in true Ty Segall fashion, no two records of his ever sound the same, and First Taste is no exception. Stylistically, this time, instead of hopping around in a myriad of different styles like he did on Goblin, or his folk on acid stylings he went for on the highly underrated Joy, First Taste is more of a garage rock record, but with a healthy amount of experimentalism along the way. Nothing the likes of his deeply disturbing but brilliant Emotional Mugger from 2016, but Taste definitely sees Segall venturing to uncharted waters, like the revving synths accompanying the crunchy guitars on opener Taste, or the beautiful and ultra-minimal Ice Planet. Another example of this is Segall toying around with country elements on the closer Lone Cowboys. For the majority of the album, Segall stays in his comfort zone, providing more than satisfactory garage rock tunes for the majority of the project. And while the songs here are great, they don't leave as much of an impression as some of Segall's best work. But all in all, that's fine. There's still a lot of great work on display here, and like every other album in Segall's ever-growing catalog, is one I'll be revisiting quite a bit, feeling a 7 out of 10 on this one. Not so much for newcomers, but definitely for the diehards.
Co-starring the powerhouse duo of Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham, returning as their beloved and titular Fast and Furious characters Luke Hobbs and Deckard Shaw, Hobbs and Shaw is the ninth film in the nearly three-decade-spanning NOS-infused action-adventure franchise, as well as the first official spin-off entry for the series. Directed by David Leitch, who was an uncredited co-director on the first John Wick, as well as the director of Atomic Blonde and Deadpool 2, Hobbs and Shaw really had a lot to live up to, not only because of the impressive track record for the recent entries in the FNF series, but also due to its stupid as hell and ridiculously fun-looking trailers. On top of all of that, the inclusion of Idris Elba as the film's antagonist and quote-unquote Black Superman, Hobbs and Shaw truly had all the ingredients it needed in order to coalesce into one of the summer's most exciting and exhilarating movie-going experiences. But does it live up to the incredible hype that both Dan and I attributed to it? What do you think, Dan?
Not really.
No?
No.
No? Not at all?
Don't know, man. Just, it was. Okay, so obviously, it being what it is, the moment I saw those trailers, and I'm just gonna come clean, sucker for anything with Dwayne Johnson in it. Grew up
Right,
a
same here.
WWE, I'll refer to it as WWF because that was when I started watching, but WWE fan. Basically, anytime I see any of those dudes in a project, and it's actually becoming more and more common where those projects are good. Here's looking at you, John Cena. I
Dave
mean,
Bautista too.
Dave Bautista. I want to go see those. I want to go see those films. I want to go see those now actors, being a part of these projects and. Just doing their thing. It just puts the biggest smile on my face, like seeing these now actors just crushing it in Hollywood and doing these like insanely entertaining films. And yes, Hobbs and Shaw definitely has its moments and is a very it's a fun watch. I had a blast watching
Popcorn
this.
movie for sure.
Absolutely. But pretty bad. It's pretty
Yeah, like
bad.
I'm honestly kind of there with you. As much as I enjoyed moments of it, the movie is definitely way too bloated.
Because going okay, and we're talking about a. I'm not gonna spoil what the subject matter was exactly that we were talking about, but we were kind of talking about big Hollywood films that have come out earlier this year. In a season that's been huge for big Hollywood movies, it's been just jam-packed. And there's a difference between, say, a movie like Child's Play, which also kind of is terrible, but I enjoyed it a lot.
It has heart. It has
It
heart
has
for
so much
sure.
heart
It
to
definitely
it.
has heart. It knows what it is. Child's Play is
And
actually really fun.
exactly, but at its core, it's kind of shitty, but I love it.
Yeah, it's like a
It's
mediocre movie made
enjoyable.
by people who like wanted to give it their best and actually comes out as a fairly good movie in the end.
Absolutely. They know what it is. They know what this project is that they're working on, and they're not taking it too seriously and just having a really great time with it, but at the same time making something that kept me engaged, and I was having so much fun with it the whole time, which is not to say that I didn't have the same reaction with Hobbs and Shaw. But there were some bits, though, that just, I think just the over machismo and humor of it kind of falls flat, where it really could have shined and really could have been a bit more than what the end result ended up being.
Right. For me, I think I totally agree with what you're saying there. Like I enjoyed it, but I think the movie is also it had like three endings.
It
Like
did.
that movie just went on and on
Literally, there
every
were four post-credit scenes
that
almost.
too, but like just like in terms of like that movie could have ended at an hour and a half and it would have been fine. But then it kept going to an hour 45 and there was a big action scene. And then it went to 2 hours and it went to 2:15. And that movie just kept dragging on and on. And one of my main dislikes of the movie was the fact that as much as I love the characters Hobbs and Shaw, and I'm a fan of the Fast and Furious series, I've actually watched all of them for the first time in a row. I watched all eight movies just a few years ago, right before Fate of the Furious came out, all for the first time, and I, became attached to these movies. I love the characters.
And that is, as I was talking with Michael before we started recording, that's actually a goal that I have, is to do the same. I want to dive headfirst into the series and give it a shot. Like, even though my enjoyment of this film wasn't huge, I feel like I'll get exactly what I wanted out of Hobbs and Shaw with the proper Fast and Furious series.
See, and I think you'll love the Fast and Furious. If you like this movie enough, I think you'll love the Fast and Furious movies just because the characters and the not necessarily the plot is better. The plot is like, kind of not what you're there for, but it's the characters and the family of it, Vin Diesel and his family.
Which there was that in this, and we'll cover that once we get into spoiler
There's
territory.
definitely, a lot of family themes in this movie, but whereas something like Fast and Furious works as a series just because of the this amalgamation of all these characters coming together and doing these crazy over-the-top stunts and action scenes and everything, and it seems like everyone's having a good time. Whereas with Hobbs and Shaw, I felt like it was such a drag to watch these two characters who I do like. I do like Hobbs and Shaw, Jason Statham and The Rock. They're both fantastic actors and, bring their own type of charisma to the movie, but their characters, and this comes from the history of the Fast and Furious franchise where Deckard Shaw, Jason Statham's character, was actually a villain in the sixth movie. That's where he was introduced. Him and Shaw, they don't like each other, or Shaw and Hobbs don't like each other, and so the entire movie is basically based around those two just going head to head and just being the biggest meatheads, and every scene of them together is who can out one-liner the other one.
Exactly. Their dialogue for the entire movie, literally up until the last scene, is just them just outmanning each other. It's funny in some bits, and no, honestly, I don't even really recall off the top of my head if there was like one moment that I was like, ah, like
I
genuinely.
think at the beginning when they first met up, like when they first saw each other for the first time and they were doing their bit, I thought that was okay.
That was
And
pretty
the
good.
like the CIA agent or whatever agent was like watching them and his reaction, it was a good bit, but
And the shots, like the way that scene was directed, it was a literal face to face. You see them, and you
big
get one
close-ups.
scene of Dwayne Johnson hurling insults at Jason Statham, who you don't see at all on the screen. Then it cuts to Jason Statham, who's just hurling insults, and you don't see Dwayne. And it works really well. And it was like a really nice way to introduce those characters, introduce the plot of them having to team up and everything. But then
But
it just continues on for the
that's
entire movie.
right. That's 25 minutes into the movie, probably, and then you
And you
have
need something
another.
like that for that, without a doubt.
But
Without a
then
doubt.
two more
But
hours of that really drags. I think the movie has great set pieces. The action, well, the movie has potential for great set pieces. I think some of the direction is a little shoddy. It's crazy to me knowing that this is the director co-director of John Wick and also the director of Atomic Blonde. And those movies, which are so visceral and the action, you can see everything and it, you know, you never lose sight of what's going on. Whereas with this movie, which, you know, of course is such a more bombastic and over the top experience, but even with the scenes where it was, you know, hand to hand combat or lesser, you know, not jumping out of a building or cars exploding and everything, it was something with the direction, just everything hit hard. Like the sound is good and the punches are good, but it just happens too fast and you can tell there's a lot of cuts.
Absolutely.
And
honestly, the plot gets a little dicey and hard to follow in some bits too. It just kind of, sense that it's complicated or something, but I kind of had moments where watching it where there was just,
like, why are we doing this?
Exactly. Perfect. Like, it was just so jumbled, and I kind of had to remind myself of, like, why the characters were in these circumstances at this point in time, and sure. I'm kind of just thinking to myself, there were a few instances while watching this, right, I had to remind myself of what was going on, because it was just kind of a mess. Like, I felt the editing was a little sloppy.
Right. I definitely think the movie could have been cut down a bit. But I will say, you know, some of the things that I really liked, obviously Jason Statham in The Rock, like, Dwayne Johnson's one of the most charismatic and best actors in Hollywood today. Like Dan said, I'll see anything that he's in, more or less.
Absolutely.
He just brings this presence, and he's such a fun guy, and he just seems like a really genuine, nice guy, outside, you know, just as a human being. So I like to support him. So he was great. Jason Statham was good. You know, they both had their funny one-liners and their funny bits. Idris Elba was good.
Idris Elba was hamming it up.
Yeah, he definitely
was. So hard. I've never seen Idris Elba be that hammy in anything. I wish I could remember specifically, because there were some moments where we looked at each other after he said a bit of dialogue or just did a certain thing, and it was just kind of like, wow.
Yeah, lots of moments in that movie where, like, I was laughing to myself. These aren't funny moments in the movie, or not necessarily supposed to be, but laughing to myself just because of the over-the-top, like, ludicrous, just everything about this movie is so weird and kind of janky.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy that this movie was made in this way, kind of.
Yeah. And again, just also seeing Idris Elba, somebody who is very widely regarded as a very serious actor. I mean, previous works include The Wire, one of the greatest television shows ever made, Luther, incredible.
He also did, like, Pacific Rim. True. That predates this. But even then, he was way more serious and much more straight-faced, whereas this,
It's a bit jarring to see him. I mean, this is completely paraphrasing, but there was almost something where I think he almost said something to along the lines of formula schmormula in the middle of this. I can't remember what that was.
It was like,
I've been trying to remember what he said, but it was so funny.
Yeah, it was definitely that exact line, but it might have been a different word, but it was definitely blank schmlank. Like, and he said that legitimately, and it was just, as he's torturing characters, and he says that, and you're just like, this is the weirdest movie. But yeah, so it had ups
his
and downs.
Character in general was just so interesting, just this bionic half robot, half man, who is programmed by this undisclosed secret empire.
It almost seems like it's an AI.
Yeah.
But it could be like a man behind the AI. It's kind of hard to tell. It's also hard to tell if this is leading into another Hobbs and Shaw sequel or if it's leading up to Fast and Furious 9.
But it'll be interesting to see, because I feel that they should tie this just directly into the Fast and Furious series. But the way you're talking about it, and if this does do really good numbers at the box office, it'll be interesting to see if this actually just kind of becomes its own little separate entity from Fast and Furious, which I think would be kind of a bad idea. I mean, granted, I haven't seen any of those films, but I feel like just knowing what they bring to the table and acting sense and star power wise, I feel like you'd want them in.
Yeah, I think
the
maybe
the Fast and Furious series from this point on, and I think, not want to just bank on this being
right
their main thing.
I feel like the thing with And obviously you're coming to it having not seen the other movies, but I think that those two characters have kind of they've run their course in the main series, I believe. So I can definitely see them, and especially with like the beef between Vin Diesel and The Rock about just the fact that this movie wasn't even made. Because, you know, Vin Diesel kind of never wanted spinoffs, apparently. He kind of wanted everything to just be his series and him to be the main star or whatever. You know, I don't know all the details about it, but it seems like they have some kind of feud. So I can honestly see this becoming Hobbs and Shaw 2 at some point. But I don't know that I'm necessarily so excited for that. Having, you know, this movie, like I said, had everything going for it. Had great trailers, you know, a great cast. A really good director behind the scenes. So for it to come out and be kind of mediocre, with some really great action scenes, but interspliced between a lot of hubbub and characters that are kind of hard to really, feel for and get attached to. So.
How did you feel about Vanessa Kirby's character, Hattie Shaw?
She's fine.
Do you think her inclusion, do you think it added or really did anything to the dynamic of the two titular characters, or no?
I kind of enjoyed like the, you know, the Rock kind of, you know, being a like a love interest for her, or like her being a love interest for him, and what that causes, you know, the feelings for Jason Statham to feel, like his character to feel about, you know, obviously he hates Hobbs and he doesn't want Hobbs to be, you know, romantically interested or even anywhere near his sister. So I thought some of that was okay, but I don't know, her as a character, she was fine. Honestly, there's not really much to that movie in terms of plot or characters otherwise. No. So it's really kind of hard to say. Like, the doctor character was, like, kind of throwaway, but he had some, like...
From The World's End.
Right, yeah, yeah, the guy from The World's End, which I totally noticed, and then I was like, that can't be him, right? And then, yeah, I think it is.
And I feel like every movie I've seen him in since The World's End, he just plays some doctor/professor guy. He's like, oh, no, no, and then, always, like, ends up in a bad place. It,
yeah. But yeah, so...
But despite that... And let's now venture into spoilers/positives territory.
Well, do you want to give like a score before we get to spoilers?
Before we get into that,
anyone wants to stop.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would give this a 5 out of 10.
Okay.
Yeah. Which basically the 5 is coming from the where we're gonna go into next, because despite me thinking this is kind of a shitty movie, there was still, I had a lot of fun with
it.
I was still thoroughly entertained. It just wasn't, going back to, you brought up John Wick earlier, this is no John Wick. Whereas John Wick is the perfect storm of being both a great film and also, goddamn, like, the action in those films there is no comparison.
Yeah.
It's in a league of its own. John Wick 3, I wish this show was rebooted around the time that was out, because I would have absolutely loved to have reviewed that. Maybe we still will. I mean, there's a Blu-ray release on the horizon. Yeah. Why not?
So I guess I would probably go around the 5 out of 10, 6 out of 10 range. I might have enjoyed it a little bit. I'm kind of torn. Like, I wanted to like this movie so much, but I think maybe the 5 out of 10 is maybe the better spot to put it at, actually. Because it is kind of mediocre.
Right.
But yeah, let's...
It's a perfect middle-of-the-road score, which is definitely how I feel about this. But yeah.
So let's
highlights and spoilers.
Spoilers?
God, that fucking... I believe that'd probably be like the second or third chase scene in the movie where Hobbs and Shaw in their McLaren, I think, go through I believe it was two semi trucks.
Yeah, two semi trucks crossing at an intersection with, like, you know, 4 feet of space, you know, between the trucks, and the McLaren goes drifting underneath in, you know, spectacular fashion, and Idris Elba's character.
Very CGI'd Idris Elba, yes. Who is practically, for some reason, there's this thing where, because he's a bionic man, he is basically linked to his motorcycle. It basically weird, moves man. With him
yeah.
and his movements.
It's like weird Transformer that motorcycle. Scene,
despite the rubbery, like, 2003 CGI that they used for Idris Elba. Great.
Yeah.
That was actually
a really action-packed scene, but had to come after, like, the most ridiculous and maybe one of the stupidest set pieces I've ever seen in a Fast and Furious movie, where The Rock jumps out of a 100-story building.
Yes, we need to talk about that.
Yeah, so I'm, like, wiping my face. I can't even believe the scene. So, like, at the CIA agency, we're talking about the scene where Idris Elba's character, I can't even remember his name because he was so whatever, but he breaks in with his...
Brixton.
Is that it? He breaks in with his special ops teams into the CIA headquarters or whatever it is, and they steal Shaw's sister, who has this virus injected into her that Brixton wants for whatever evil scheme that melts people's bodies or whatever it is. He wants to end the world so that he wants to get rid of the lowest form of humans, the people who, you know, cannot sustain human life, so that he can create a better world with only superhumans. And so she has this virus injected in her, and he wants it, and he steals her, and they propel or repel off the side of a building with using ropes, and it was so ridiculous. And then Hobbs gets the idea to not take the elevator that's right, 2 feet away to get to the bottom of the building.
Which Shaw does. He does not like being told what to do.
Because he doesn't like being told what to do, which comes back around for him later in the movie. But
for more manly one-upping.
I guess, as much as Idris Elba's character is the Black Superman, I guess The Rock's character, Hobbs, is the Samoan Superman.
Yeah.
Because he literally rides down a rope with his arms. He gets no rope burn on his arms, riding hundreds of miles per hour down this rope off a 100-story building, jumping from one rope to the other to land on one of the guys who's rappelling down the building, and then he jumps from him to the other guy, finally coalescing into him jumping onto Idris Elba's character through a glass pane, all while this is happening at 100 miles per hour. Yep. And then he gets up. And he's fine. And then they go and drive and do the crazy through the truck scene. And, that's kind of that's this movie. It's just the most over-the-top, crazy set pieces. And
it's essentially kind of a superhero movie. It is. Without being a superhero movie.
It is a superhero movie in many ways. And
it's like what most people think superhero movies are that have never seen a superhero movie. Yeah. But don't know, the level of storytelling that you could achieve with actual comic book characters. Like, I feel like most people think that this is probably what, Avengers is like. Right, I've never seen any of those movies before.
These characters, it seems like they can just take hits and, can survive anything, and it just gets so wild. And I think that's one of the real down points of this movie, is that it's, like, not grounded at all.
Another down point, the soundtrack. Good lord.
The soundtrack it's consistent.
A compilation of generic modern pop tracks that you've never heard and will never hear, because none of these songs will take off anywhere other than being in the soundtrack.
It's like what you
It's really funny.
It's like what you would hear in commercials, but, like, not the songs you know.
Right.
It's ridiculous, and sometimes the movie would have, like, montages where it would go between, like, three different songs, like, without, like, a cut. Like, it would just play one song, and it would go to the next scene, and it would be another song playing. It's just like, why are we listening? I don't want to listen to these songs. This is bad. That was bad.
Absolutely. It's so funny, and it's just so glaring, just because, I don't know, I mean, maybe just it's the music nerd in me that kind of really like signaled it on that, but it was just so jarring for some reason and just like so stand out to me just how bad the choice of music in that movie
it can
was.
Be a detriment because you it know really can. Honestly, movies with good soundtracks can be a really great positive.
Mm-hmm.
You look at like something like The Graduate with like, you know, absolutely. Stuff like that, or like even Tarantino's new film Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh,
like great soundtrack
example of that.
So
absolutely.
You know, something with a bad soundtrack can be a detriment to a film as much as a good soundtrack can be a, you know, a positive. So
100%.
I totally agree that really stood out as being like one of the maybe the worst soundtrack to a movie I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
At That's least it's up there. For sure. It's up there.
I would have to say though, one of the biggest highlights or one of the parts of the movie where I feel like it really hit a stride though is when they wind up in Samoa, which yeah. I'm kind of blanking right now as to why they wound up there.
They went there because the sister is like wanted for, you know, conspiracy, whatever. But they need somewhere to go where they won't be tracked, so they go to Samoa, and also The Rock's brother, who he hasn't seen in like 30 years, is also like a great mechanic.
There
and
we
can
go.
Fix the like machine that can get the virus out of the sister.
Going back to that family element of the Fast and Furious.
You gotta
series.
Go back to the family. A lot of scenes with, you know, The Rock and his daughter, and the random cameo with Ryan Reynolds.
Let's save that for a second, because
sure.
There's a good amount of cameos that we need to talk about.
We'll talk about
film.
The cameos. But yeah, so the finale of this film ends up in Samoa, and it's actually really...
It's great.
It's actually really fun.
It's
you know,
really
the,
great.
They turn off, they get into the system for the guns, for the Etienne, which is the evil organization that Brixton works for, and all their guns have like these... basically IDs on them that like activate them so that they can shoot, and they hack into it and they get rid of their guns because The Rock and his family of, you know, all of his brothers, his Usos, as he calls them, who are all big barrel chested people.
I'm very impressed you remembered that.
It stood out to me. So,
that's amazing.
Yeah. So they have this like war between them with their like old tribal weapons because the mother wanted to get rid of their guns at some point because whatever family history. So they have like these old...
She was just simply like, we don't use guns.
Right.
Stick to tradition.
Right.
Which was pretty dope.
It was cool. So like, you know, they set up overnight this crazy elaborate, death house or like death island
mm-hmm.
for when the Etienne soldiers get there, and it's this awesome standoff between the
Rock's
Rock.
Brother wearing AirPods making crazy shit.
Yeah, it was
souping
it was
up cars. It was great.
Roman Reigns speared a guy.
Yes,
Roman Reigns another WWE
cameos,
another WWE
film.
Wrestler who comes in, and he honestly
has
no lines.
Dialogue.
He literally
at
did
all.
Not say a single thing.
He just looks approvingly, does that cool move that Michael just mentioned, and he fist bumps a lot of people.
Yeah, lots of fist bumps in the montages for this final scene.
Do you think Roman Reigns is also going to end up? Like his wrestling career, how people don't really like him. Do you think he's going to take a stab at a movie career and just going to get roles like this?
Not after this one. This movie tells me no, because they did not give him lines. And if they did not give him
That's
lines, that probably
though.
Means he's bad.
I feel like he's going to also be the one wrestler who takes a stab at acting and is just going to fall on his face. Just like with wrestling, which is unfortunate.
Right.
Poor Roman Reigns.
Yeah,
I feel like
for Roman Reigns, honestly.
Yeah, for real. He's been through a lot. And honestly, I mean, his character is pretty awful in wrestling. But
sure. Yeah,
I mean, I feel for the
guy. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But I think the final...
One day we'll do a full wrestling-centric episode.
WrestleMania comes around once a year.
Ooh, baby. That's going to be great. Or terrible, because WrestleMania is kind of hard to get through.
Yeah, it's been awful. But yeah, I think the finale of this movie was actually pretty good. You know, they got four kicks of NOS in four different cars,
bro.
Which was really cool when The Rock is, you know, basically playing tug of war with a helicopter.
Yes, we have to mention that. That was insane.
Another point as to how The Rock is totally Samoan Superman.
Mm-hmm.
He's totally a human being, but he can... play tug of war with this helicopter and have no problem.
There's also a scene where he was about to enter in a room with very heavy gunfire and he just wore a bulletproof vest just covering his torso with arms fully exposed.
Yeah, Jason Statham definitely covered from head to toe in you know, bulletproof armor, but The Rock, his arms, they must just
see those biceps.
You can't get obviously a bulletproof.
No way. No how.
And I think the final confrontation between The Rock, Jason Statham, and Idris Elba's characters, where it was a 2-on-1 fight between the Superman and the Black Superman versus Samoan Superman, and also like little Jason Statham.
Yep.
But it was fun. It was it was downpour. You know, real rainy. It had a cool look to it, and
I feel like we also have to mention that. I thought it was super funny at the very beginning of the film when Brixton, Idris Elba's character, someone asks him, "Who are you?" And he just says, "I'm the bad guy." And to be honest, I think it was halfway through the film and I'm seeing Brixton on screen and it took me a minute to remember, did they actually say his name or is he just been referred to as the bad guy
honestly,
at this point in the film? But then I remembered, oh yeah, his sister was like, "That's Brixton. Okay. He's part of
all that went over
the organization."
My head.
And
at
blah,
some
blah,
point,
blah.
You know, it's an action movie. It had a plot, I guess, but it was so bare bones.
I would have almost respected that more if they never referred to him as anything.
He's just a bad guy.
Just doesn't. It's Idris Elba, bad guy. Yeah. But yeah, the Samoa bit. Absolutely great when they're piling up all those cars and, you know, trying to weigh down the helicopter that Brixton is in. Phenomenal stuff.
Yeah, it was
pretty
fun.
Was again, like, that was what I was there for. It was totally great. But Cameo City, damn, there was a lot of really weird, unexpected, unwanted cameos in this.
Yeah, so Ryan Reynolds shows up as a character, as like an ex-partner of Hobbs.
Playing Deadpool, basically.
Yeah, more or less playing Deadpool, but yeah. Has a real, like, he thinks he's he's family with Hobbs, but Hobbs definitely does not return that. That was really weird. He was sort of funny sometimes,
which is,
I guess,
Ryan Reynolds' MO.
Yeah.
But at least that's how I feel about him,
sure,
personally.
Yeah.
I could do with less Ryan Reynolds than anything.
Take him or leave him, honestly.
Yeah. Same with the next cameo.
Yeah,
Kevin
this
Hart.
One had a pop. The audience clapped. They were excited when Kevin Hart came out, who was like a air marshal.
He played Kevin Hart.
He played Kevin Hart. You know, as much as Ryan Reynolds played Deadpool, Kevin Hart.
Little guy who's like, yeah, I can do things. I have so many skills and confidence.
I can be tough.
I'm Kevin Hart.
I could be like you, Rock.
Right.
But, yeah, super weird. Like, and I'll give him credit for. I had no idea either of those cameos were coming. Like they like played significant enough parts. Like Ryan Reynolds had a fair amount of screen time, as much as like 5 to 10 minutes, and Kevin
That's
Hart
true.
Was like in it for a scene or two. And
I mean, not to mention that Ryan Reynolds also had two of those end credit scenes.
Yeah, two end credit scenes dedicated.
I will say though, I very much liked the. When they called back to there was a bit of dialogue where in the opening scene where Brixton murders a bunch of, I don't know what the fuck those guys were,
MI6,
there we go, and they found one with a brick stabbed through his heart.
Yeah,
and they call back to that. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah,
and especially the way that they do it and involving Ryan Reynolds' character, that was pretty good.
It was actually pretty funny, and it was well edited. So yeah,
thirdly, Roman Reigns going out to the WWE,
and then I don't know
family.
who the woman was who they like end up getting like supplies from. She looked familiar.
She was in Baby Driver.
Elsa Gonzalez or something. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that was John Hamm's character's love interest in Baby Driver.
Right. Okay. I knew it from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. Overall, Very mediocre film. Kind of disappointing, honestly.
Biggest disappointment of all, and speaking of cameos, no Vin.
No Vin.
Where's Vin? No Vin. That warrants the five alone. I mean,
that is another tip to me that they're not going to be... This has nothing to do with Fast and Furious 9. This isn't going to lead into that. This is its own spin-off series. They're not going to... Well, Rock and, you know, Hobbs and Shaw might come back into Fast and Furious at some point, but the fact that there's no Vin in this movie is really, really one, disappointing, and two, kind of an indicator to me that this is its own separate thing.
Yep. It's a shame. Don't turn your back on family.
Yeah. Fuck you, Rock.
Right?
Just kidding.
Did you see how... Yeah, exactly. We love you, Dwayne. We love you. And Jason Statham, too.
Yeah.
And Idris Elba.
And Idris Elba.
Love all you guys. You did what you could.
Yeah.
You did what you could. What about you guys out there? Did you see Hobbs and Shaw? We'd love to hear from you about it, what you thought of it. You can email us at infinitecanvasult@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at ICUUltraPod. Yeah, we'd love to get your take on it if you guys have seen it, or if you just want to ask us why we saw it. Well, we just explained it, you know?
Yeah.
You can understand. We're not just all art house criterion films over here at Canvas.
We like to have fun. I'm a big fan of Fast and Furious.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a great series, I'm sure. I can't wait to finally delve into it. We might do a series of episodes on that.
Hell yeah, I would be totally down to do that. I would love to watch and rewatch and speak about the Fast and Furious films at some point.
Daniel goes Fast and Furious. Let's go, baby. But first off, we're going to take a break, and we're going to close it out for this week. Alright, welcome back to Infinite Canvas Ultra. So to close out this week's show, we're going to enter our mailbag here and answer some questions that we got from our adoring fans. First one being from, well, look at that, written here by my very own bro, my flesh and blood, John. Thanks, John. What a good way to enter in this, you know, this segment, one that I hope is going to be a fan favorite. It's always good communicating with people, with their public, and let alone my own brother. It's very sweet. It's touching. Sweet. It's touching. John writes in asking, what is your lineup for the MCU X-Men? Roster can be between 4 to 8 characters deep, not including Charles Xavier, which is fair.
Yeah.
It's fair. Why would you include him in there? He's, you know.
He's got to be there.
Just manning the whole operation. I don't know. I think, honestly, I mean, Wolverine's an obvious one. He's kind of a character that needs to be in the MCU, I feel. Just kind of adds a lot to that spectrum of characters and just would be important to have. Cyclops, obviously, is kind of the de facto team leader.
Right.
And, honestly, I mean, I think I'm going to probably range more on the 8 because there's no way I can keep this to 4. I don't think you could like plausibly keep an MCU version of X-Men just down to 4 characters.
I think it would have to be stupid. Minimum like 6 at least.
Yeah. I think Jean Grey, obviously Jean Grey definitely would need to be a part. Storm would definitely need to be a part of it. Those four, I think Beast also would be very important. Angel, and especially also, you know, I'm gonna go Beast, Angel, and Iceman, because I feel like it would be very much in MCU form to initially introduce the X-Men as the core team, which the core original team as they first appeared was Cyclops, Jean Grey, Angel, Iceman, and Beast. Yeah. And I think Wolverine and Storm are kind of the perfect, I guess you could say, additions. More recent.
Right.
I mean, they came out in the 70s or whatever the fuck, but...
not original lineup.
Right, like, they are the two characters that kind of, I feel, are ultra crucial to what makes the X-Men so great and kind of the most, like, recognizable and important characters to that team. So I think just leaving it at that would be perfect. I think those would be the perfect characters to have introduced and whatever the first iteration of the X-Men and the MCU would be.
Yeah.
How do you feel on that?
So while you're going very, I guess, standard or typical, kind of very similar to what the original X-Men movies were, like their first X-Men movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very similar lineup. I guess I guess that's kind of where I was leaning towards too. At least that makes sense to me. That's probably what they'll do. I would love to see Nightcrawler in there.
That would be great.
I would also like to see Gambit actually get his chance, get his real chance.
That would.
That would be really great. I don't know that we need a Wolverine. I don't know that they can do Wolverine.
You don't think so?
For me. You know, just Hugh Jackman was so pivotal to that character, and we saw his arc, and we saw all those movies already.
Mm-hmm.
I think Wolverine's played out at this point.
I can see that.
I don't know that we necessarily need him in the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
I love Storm. I think that would be great. My girlfriend would love to see her and Black Panther get together and be a thing.
But she wants to play Storm, too.
Wants to play Storm, yes. Hopefully that happens. I'm crossing my fingers.
That'd be great. Getting some Marvel money.
That would be crazy. She's not an actress, but who knows? It could happen.
Big break.
I don't know. I'm not, you know, Dan's much more of a X-Men fan than I am. So he obviously has more of a history with the characters and can probably pull a much better list of characters than I could. But I guess I would probably go with, I like Beast a lot. Nightcrawler's really cool. You obviously have to have Cyclops.
Colossus.
Yeah, Colossus would be cool.
But, you know.
I wonder how this is all going to work, actually, with Deadpool. Because I'm sure that they'll keep Deadpool. And Colossus has been in the Deadpool movies.
That's true. That's true.
Well, yeah, I wonder. Because, like, Deadpool is such a big series for them and hasn't gone down the shitter like the regular X-Men movies have. Love or hate the Deadpool movies, you know, as much as you're not, you know, into those movies. Like, they're big hits they were big hits for Fox. So.
Exactly.
I'm sure that Disney will want to keep that coming in, but...
Also, going back to last week's episode, when we were talking about House of X by Jonathan Hickman...
Right.
I would honestly lay good money that the concepts that are being laid out in that book, excuse me, which are... appearing to not be the traditional sense of X-Men at all, mm-hmm. is how these characters are going to... be revealed into the cinematic universe, that Charles Xavier is basically this godlike creature who has been creating mutants and, like, you know, just creating mutants throughout the entire planet for years and is, like, assembling them to be his followers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is what we're gonna get. I honestly don't even think these characters are going to be referred to as the X-Men, in all honesty.
You don't think so?
I really don't.
In the book or in the MCU?
Both.
Oh.
That just seems to be the direction that they're taking it. And I feel like that's some kind of weird thing that's come from the, like, legal thing with the Fox acquisition. I mean, I don't know for a fact, but right. just from that, and then also during the reveal of Phase 4 or whatever the fuck that mm-hmm. Kevin Feige was revealing at San Diego Comic-Con. He mentions the Fantastic Four as a Fantastic Four, but he mentions these characters as just mutants. So and that's exactly what's happening in that House of X book. So, right. Marvel, yes, they still produce very good comics, but I'd be lying if I was saying that it's not. They always show their hand. And the movies always usually have some kind of reflection in the comic books. Certain characters will just pop up depending on the writer, obviously they make it work, but you could just sort of see through it mm-hmm. and, like, know what's coming next. And I think that that is just extremely obvious that that's the route that they're going to be going. And I'm all for it. Hopefully they take another step forward and maybe give Jonathan Hickman a screenwriting credit on that movie.
I think
that would be amazing.
I would totally be down for that, just because, you know, the X-Men, well, the first movie was 2000. We're, you know, heading upon 20 years of the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
And with how much of a shit show X-Men Dark Phoenix was, I think it would be really good for the Marvel Cinematic Universe to introduce them as something totally new, something we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
You know, kind of... you know, an introduction like sort of how they did with Spider-Man, where, you know, instead of doing the entire Spider-Man introduction again and doing, you know, Uncle Ben dying and whatnot, you know, going a different route and introducing them in a smart and, you know, just clever way. I think they need to do something new with the X-Men to really make them stand out and be something anyone actually cares about.
Exactly. And I mean, you haven't read the book yet, but I mean, from everything I've told you about it so far, I mean,
House of X sounds great. And yeah, I mean, I would love to see that, you know, just from the little tidbits I've heard, I would love to see that translated into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That just seems to be the way that they're going to do it. And then we got another question here from Ian Scherer, the host of 616 Entertainment Podcast. Big shout out to him. I may have been on that show once or twice. This is another question referring to the MCU, and that in the recently announced Doctor Strange 2, which is supposed to be a movie about the multiverse, he's asking if we think Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield will appear in there, which is a big fan speculation thing that's really been going on lately, that Tobey Maguire would pop up as like a
Cameo,
you know,
or something?
Yeah, and Andrew Garfield pop up, you know, incorporating these different iterations of Spider-Man that have appeared through the years in film, getting another chance to shine in a movie. I think that it is a huge pipe dream.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I frankly, like, I could go either way on that. Frankly, I just want the, if we're going to get anything to continue on from, well, I really don't want to see the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very exciting at all. Continued
on in any way. I mean, like, he could have been a good Spider-Man, I guess. I mean, but those movies are just abysmal. They're horrible. But if the Sam Raimi-verse were to continue in a comic book form, like it was heavily rumored earlier this year, I wouldn't say no to that. I mean, right. That script for Spider-Man 4 is finished. It's just hanging out there. And
is that readable? Can you read that somewhere?
I don't know. I haven't looked
into
that. It's
probably out
there
somewhere, right?
It's got to be.
I feel like scripts are always leaking onto the internet. That's probably out there somewhere.
It's got to be. And yeah, if we were to get a, I mean, obviously a film would never be made. That would just be ridiculous unless,
right,
somehow Sony just went crazy and we're like, yeah, let's just make another Spider-Man movie congruent to this already huge Spider-Man franchise going on. Would never happen. But yeah, if a comic book were ever to be put out about that and you could just, you know, wrap up the story, wrap up a very great franchise that was horribly, horribly kneecapped, like the Raimi franchise was. Also a franchise that all these movies pretty much owe everything to, that and Nolan's Batman trilogy. I mean, they...
And X-Men, right?
And X-Men. Yeah, we wouldn't have... This wouldn't
and
be this
Blade.
Huge-ass... Yeah, and Blade. And Blade.
Can't forget Blade.
Exactly.
It actually predates all those other movies.
It does. 98. Yeah. It's 21 years old now.
Yeah. Can insane. Drink.
Those are the founding fathers of basically what Hollywood is now.
Yeah, actually.
Christ.
Hobbs and Shaw has a lot in relation to Blade, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Has a lot to owe to Blade somehow, but
yeah. But yeah, like, I would love to see it that way, but to answer the question, I don't think that would ever happen.
I don't think so either.
But I hope so, because the fans want it, and let's make those fans
I'm
happy.
Just excited to
cool.
see what that movie is.
I am too. I am very excited. I mean, I do think we'll get some funky shit that you would not ever expect to appear in a movie. I frankly think Marvel zombies will probably happen in this.
Ooh, that would be cool. It is supposed to be a horror movie.
Exactly. And I mean, that's the most well-known popular Marvel horror property to ever exist. And
get Robert Kirkman his money.
Right?
More Let him money, run right? more money.
I do think, if anything, there's going to be a scene where Doctor Strange probably winds up in that universe for a minute, and we'll see those iterations of those characters,
that would be
which
cool.
would be absolutely amazing.
That would be awesome.
So cool.
That would be really cool. Hopefully then they did the Marvel Zombies versus Army of Darkness. So hopefully Bruce Campbell can come back. And maybe that's he was in Spider-Man, same Spider-Man, so maybe it is kind of totally crossing over everything.
It's true. Did you know part of that Spider-Man 4 script that entire time that was Mysterio?
Like, behind everything?
Yes, behind all the Bruce Campbell cameos, because the beginning of Spider-Man 4 is Spider-Man swinging around through the city, or what was supposed to be Spider-Man 4, and he's just taking on a bunch of, like, lower-level criminals, and there's supposed to be a scene, like, it cuts, like, the last part of it is him taking this Mysterio into the police headquarters, they take the helmet off and it's Bruce Campbell. So
wow,
Bruce Campbell was Mysterio the whole time, yeah, fucking with Peter Parker.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's why I want this project to exist in some capacity just for that. Like,
that's awesome.
I'm so sad we never got that.
Yeah.
Instead we got those
amazing
dumb
Spider-Man.
Andrew Garfield movies. Hell, I mean, yeah. It is too bad, but
we're in a good spot now with the new Spider-Man movies.
Yeah.
We got a good Mysterio with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, so. Yeah. That was a great film. I really enjoyed that. I would love to catch that again sometime. That was a fun movie. But yeah, thanks for those questions, guys. And as always, you can email us at infinitecanvasult@gmail.com, or you can hit us up at Twitter at @ICUUltrapod.
And that's actually IC Ultrapod, not ICU. IC Ultrapod.
There we go. It's been a long day, guys. I'm
tired. Yeah, no, totally fair. Did you have any shout-outs before we got out of here?
Yeah. I mean, I've... Shout-outs. Yeah, I'm going to shout-out Dwayne Johnson, Jason Statham, and Idris Elba again. The entire Hobbs and Shaw crew.
Hell yeah.
Thank you for the popcorn entertainment, even though... It wasn't the greatest thing I've ever seen, but hey.
It was alright, yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate it. How about you, Michael? You got any shout-outs?
I'm going to shout out... Oh, God. What do I shout out? I know I had something kicking earlier, but now I don't anymore. I've forgotten it.
Well, maybe it'll come back.
We'll shout it out next time.
Can I also give a shout-out to Ty Siegel, who just... makes albums all the time, and like, you know, they're good. They're always good.
Seems like every 4 months I see a Pitchfork article about Ty Segall's new album, and it's just like, how do you make 4 albums a year?
Yep.
Every year
he did like a few covers albums. He's in between the other albums that he was putting out. Like, I think last year he put out like 2 covers albums in the midst of 2 other albums that were all original material. So he just never stops, and I appreciate it. I've been a fan of him for a long time, so it was cool getting a little chance to talk about his new album, which at the time of recording this came out today, so shout out to him.
I am going to shout out something, and it's the Netflix lineup for August.
Yeah.
Because Netflix in August...
I honestly haven't looked at it, so break the news here.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the whole thing is, but from what I know from series that I really enjoy, Mindhunter Season 2 comes out this month. Glow Season 3 comes out this month.
Glow.
And actually, the day we're recording this, August 2nd, which will have passed by the time you hear this, Dear White People Volume 3 comes out. And all three of those shows are really fantastic. I can't speak highly enough of all of those. And I've really needed something to watch with my Netflix subscription for a few months now. I guess Stranger Things happened last month, but that was more Stranger Things. So I'm really excited for this month to actually... utilize my Netflix subscription, which I don't always do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'll shout out the Netflix subscription service this month.
I think I'm gonna do my last shout out with that too, because I also, just for the hell of it, speaking of using your Netflix subscription, just threw on again, I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson.
Ooh, yes.
Which, shout out to Tim Robinson and that show, and being the funniest show I've seen in all of 2019.
Yeah.
It is absolutely hilarious. I just had that on while I was getting ready for work this morning, and I almost just couldn't, because like there's just so many bits that just They had me
a
keeling over laughing.
laughter-induced coma from that show.
It's the best. I think we should also potentially review Glow when that comes
Oh
out.
yeah. Yeah. We
That'd be
should maybe talk
great.
about Mindhunter as well when that comes
I
out.
actually never watched that. I'll have to
No?
catch up
Have you
on
watched
it.
Glow?
Yeah.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, I
Oh,
love
okay. I
Glow.
didn't know you watched
Glow
Glow.
is awesome.
Hell
Glow is
yeah.
really, really
Hell
good.
yeah.
So I'm stoked for that new season.
Hell yeah, I am too.
But yeah, I guess it's been real as always, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks everybody for listening to this episode of Infinite Canvas Ultra.
Ultra.
We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.